James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes in the dispersion, greetings. Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. But let him ask in faith, with no doubting. For the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea that is driven and tossed by the wind. For that person must not suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. He is a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways.
Gordon MacDonald was a well-known author and pastor, and he said this in a sermon. He said, I used to struggle with overconfident intelligentsia while living in Boston. Intelligentsia means the smart people. I would leave the town of Lexington, where my family and I lived, and would drive past the towers of Harvard University. Another mile down the road on the left sits the campus of MIT, and to the right, the campus of Boston University. Straight ahead were the towering headquarters of many great multinational corporations. There were moments when I was tempted to be intimidated by these unmitigated, unadulterated symbols of power. Here were great world leaders being trained in the business school at Harvard. Over at MIT, signals bounced off Mars every 30 seconds. In those towers, decisions were being made that created and destroyed the economies all over the world. Who was I? What was our congregation with this Christian gospel trying to preach? I have felt that myself many times. Who am I? What in the world can I say to reach anybody for anything? What could I possibly offer to anyone? Have you ever felt that way? So one of the things that James talks about in our passage is wisdom. We have God's wisdom available to us. And this wisdom is far different than the wisdom of the people that Gordon MacDonald describes there in Boston. God's wisdom is not really impressed, not even not really. God's wisdom is not impressed with Harvard or MIT. Or any of the rest of it. The kingdom of God is exactly opposite to these things. The culmination of the wisdom of God is actually a torture stick. The cross. That's the culmination of the wisdom of God. It's actually through suffering and shame and difficulty that the wisdom of the kingdom comes to bear. So what I want to look at here is God's view of wisdom. I want us to see two things from this passage, just two very simple things. What it is and the path to get it. What it is and the path to get it. So number one, what it is. If we were to define wisdom, it would be something like this, or my shot at defining it. Wisdom is the ability to see through things, to see their ultimate value. The ability to see through things, to see their ultimate value. Well, you might not be surprised that the Bible sees wisdom only in relation to God. We have that verse in Proverbs. It's actually in various places in Proverbs, but this is Proverbs 9, verse 10. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. So What the Bible portrays is that wisdom is about understanding the world from God's perspective. That's real wisdom. If he's in the mix, from his perspective, that's where real wisdom is. If he's not there, it's not wisdom. It's not real wisdom. And the world from God's perspective is very different from the world from our perspective. So what has happened to wisdom? Wisdom from our culture's perspective has had a profound shift, and it's moving further and further away from God's perspective on the world, and people are leaving belief in God in droves. Well, what is actually driving that? Why are people leaving the church and God in droves? There's a movement in the West that started in the late 19th century that in spite of many criticisms that it's had, and even modern day criticisms, it persists today. It's a view that insists that you cannot believe anything unless you have definite proof. The idea is that genuine knowledge can only come from reason or logic that you can see. In other words, you have to see it to believe it. This means that other ways of knowing, especially religious faith, are to be rejected because you can't prove it. This view has a label. It's called positivism. And it has hugely influenced Western culture, though it does have its critics. But probably one of its most famous proponents was the physicist Stephen Hawking. He wasn't actually writing papers on positivism, but he definitely looked at the world through that viewpoint. You only believe what you can actually prove in front of your face. So what has that meant for today? Well, people have pitted science against religion. They say that they believe in science because science offers proof, but religion is just about faith. It doesn't have any proof. So what are we to say to this? Michael Polanyi, in his book Personal Knowledge, talks about two kinds of awareness. Just bear with me for a second here. He talks about two kinds of awareness. One is the kind of awareness that you can see, which he calls focal awareness. It's what I can, everything around me that I see, this is what I'm aware of at the moment. But then he talks about another kind of awareness. The other is all of the assumptions that you make that are operating in the background but are not recognized. He calls this subsidiary awareness, things you're not focusing on, but all of your assumptions. He says that everything we believe and focus on comes with a whole set of unseen assumptions or pre-understandings, as he calls them, that come from our upbringing, our culture, our friends, the current prevailing thought, and a whole host of things. So let me give you an example that is prevalent in our society. Everybody thinks that human rights is a good thing, is a right thing, that we should fight for human rights. But you can't prove that by what you see, right? All you have to do is look at nature, and it completely refutes the idea of human rights. If you go out into the animal kingdom, they're killing each other left and right. Everything you see is survival of the fittest. It's why we have Darwinian evolution, because all they see in nature is survival of the fittest. So human rights, where does that come from? You can't see it, you can't prove it, and yet most people believe in it. Well, it's a holdover from Christianity, obviously. Obviously, in the Bible, we believe in human rights because God says it, and it's everywhere in the Bible, right? So people have assumptions. They may believe that science and what I see, I will only believe in what I see, but they have a whole host of assumed things, things that they believe in that are back there in the back. So what does that have to do with the profound shift in our society? Well, for the most part, Western society has ignored all of these presuppositions about life, and they insist that unless they can see God, then he must not be there, or at least he cannot be known, and he is not personal. So what does this do to wisdom? Well, it makes wisdom a profoundly personal path where you will only accept what you actually see, and it ignores the fact that you come to life with this whole set of presuppositions and reasons why you live the way you live and believe the way you believe. It's actually a blindness. Wisdom is actually just what I see, just what's in front of my face, whatever I think is right, that's it. Sociologist Charles Taylor explains about the belief system of modern people. This is what he says: culturally, our belief and confidence in the powers of our own intellect have changed. Ancient people did not assume that the human mind had enough wisdom to sit in judgment on how an infinite God was disposing of things. It is only in modern times that we get the certainty that we have all the elements we need to carry out a trial of God. And that's what's happening. People putting God on trial, they don't see him, and yet they have all these presuppositions underneath it all. So wisdom then is what I make of it. It is what I see with my eyes. It is what I reason with my brain. It is what I think is right. I decide what is wise or not wise. And then we get to the book of James. And it says, if any of you lacks wisdom, which is everybody, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. What is the assumption here? Is that we don't have wisdom, but God does. The whole presupposition of the Bible is God is the one with wisdom. We don't have any, and we need him to get wisdom. It's exactly opposite from what's going on in our world. So what kind of wisdom is he talking about? Is it, I don't think he's referring to wisdom. When we think about wisdom, sometimes we just think about good decisions for life or being smart in what you do in business or making right decisions about certain things. But see, in the context here in James, I think he's talking about the wisdom to understand why the world is the way it is and why people suffer. That's what I think he's talking about here. The wisdom of God that he's talking about is why people suffer, to understand the way of God in the world. And that brings me to my second point, the pathway to get wisdom. So number two, the path to get it. Why do I think he's talking about suffering? Well, it's right there. Verse two, count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. So according to these verses, suffering produces steadfastness, and steadfastness makes you perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. But then the very next verse assumes that we won't understand our suffering, and that it won't perfect us in this life. We don't get it. And so he says, if any of you lacks the wisdom, let him ask of God. In other words, you don't understand why you're suffering. You need wisdom for this. You really need wisdom for this. It's to understand God's heart for suffering. So let's look at that. It's this massive paradox that the Bible always gives us. It doesn't make sense to the average person who defines life by themselves. If I'm defining life by what I see in front of me, then suffering does not compute. What is the paradox? To count it joy when we face trials or suffering. What? To count it joy? Are you serious? Who would consider it joy to face adversity and suffering? It seems like it's the opposite of wisdom. It seems foolhardy. It seems like an impossible oxymoron. But then James tells us why it should bring joy. And he says in verse 3, "For you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing." Why should we have joy? Because of what the suffering produces in us. So steadfastness here is actually defined as the inward fortitude necessary to withstand hardship or stress. The inward fortitude necessary to withstand hardship or stress. Suffering for the Christian is what fire is to gold. Peter tells us this in 1 Peter. Suffering to the Christian is what fire is to gold. It purifies. It purifies. So why do we struggle to see this? In his book, New Rules, the late social scientist, public opinion analyst, and college professor, Daniel Yankelevich, documented a shift in social values in the 70s, a shift more massive and more rapid than any of the recent past. The book was subtitled "Searching for Self-Fulfillment in a World Turned Upside Down." So the old rules, Yankelevich says, stress duty to others, particularly to one's family. And if someone were selfish and got caught, it was embarrassing and it looked ugly. But no longer. In what he calls the duty to self ethic, which goes right along with the other things I've been talking about, the duty to self ethic, our primary responsibility is for our own needs and interests. All other relationships and values must fit into that order of priority. So he feels that the movement actually might be liberating. But at least he's an honest scientist, because after tracking some 3,000 people in personal in-depth interviews and analyzing hundreds of thousands of questionnaires, he admits that the search for self-fulfillment has been futile. It actually resulted in insecurity and confusion. So this is a real scientist doing a real scientific study, and he's still searching. He thinks it might have real possibilities, and yet he has not found anything that has been worth it in this duty to self-ethic. It has only ended up in insecurity and confusion. And then he asks, what is self-fulfillment? When you find yourself, what will you do with yourself? All these questions about self-fulfillment. So what this has produced is a society that absolutely wants nothing to do with suffering and doesn't understand it. They have no category for it. No category for suffering. In fact, it seems to have become the war cry of the younger generation. Anyone or anything that would infringe on my personal rights or make me suffer or take my comfort must be vehemently opposed. We have instant everything, all designed with our comfort in mind and our self-fulfillment in mind. And so this thought of James that somehow suffering is to be rejoiced in is absurd to most people. It's absurd. How can anyone have joy in suffering? Why would we do this? Why would we do it? Well, he says it's because it makes us strong. So there's this contrast in the passage. There seems to be a contrast. Those who take joy in their suffering develop perseverance, but those who don't are absolutely devastated by suffering. So we've already seen that the one who asks for wisdom is the one that can have joy in suffering. But what about the one who is lacking in faith? It tells us in verse 6, "But let him ask in faith with no doubting, for the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea that is driven and tossed by the wind. For that person must not suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. He is a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways." So what is it that he won't receive from the Lord? Well, I believe it's the joy of the Lord in suffering, which produces steadfastness. See, without this, he's called a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. Have you ever felt unstable in your suffering? Like, all I got to do is get out of this. And I got to plead with the Lord to end my suffering. Plead with him. Dave Dravecki, in an article for Christianity Today, says this: in America, Christians pray for the burden of suffering to be lifted from their backs. In the rest of the world, Christians pray for stronger backs so they can bear their suffering. In the Christian life, suffering is a given. It's a given. I think he has such a point. We beg God to take away our suffering, and when he doesn't, we're devastated. We wonder where he is. We wonder what he's doing. What in the world are you doing, God? But the essence of wisdom is that we would ask him to give us joy in the midst of the suffering, that we would learn what he wants us to learn, that we would gain perseverance, and that we would be used in his kingdom with or without the suffering. But see, if we ask for these things, if we ask for more wisdom, then he will give them to us, and more likely it'll involve more suffering. And so we don't ask because we don't want that. And we have a short vision. We just see the suffering. We don't see the perseverance. We don't see the joy that comes from trusting him. Malcolm Muggeridge, the British journalist, said the following: contrary to what might be expected, I look back on experiences that at the time seemed especially desolating and painful with particular satisfaction. Indeed, I can say with complete truthfulness that everything I have learned in my 75 years in this world, everything that has truly enhanced and enlightened my experience, has been through affliction and not through happiness. He came to Christ later in his life, and he understood the wisdom of God about his entire life, about all of the suffering that he might have gone through. So why should we embrace our suffering? Verse 4, and let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. So what does it look like to be perfect and complete? And I'm mesmerized by this verse, or these two verses in Psalm 112. For the righteous will never be moved. Those who are in Christ are the righteous. For the righteous will never be moved. He will be remembered forever. He is not afraid of bad news. His heart is firm, trusting in the Lord. There's two kinds of suffering. There's suffering with purpose, and there's suffering out of control. The one who suffers with purpose is the one that trusts in the Lord and begins to have inward peace and joy. That is steadfastness. That is what he begins to work for those who trust in the Lord. But the one that does not understand that suffering has a purpose is the one that feels out of control, full of fear, things falling apart, and it makes them angry and bitter, unstable or restless, no peace. It's what James says. There's two ways to suffer. So why is it that we struggle so much to trust in the Lord? Because that seems to be the linchpin, doesn't it? The trust in the Lord when suffering comes, when hardship comes. Well, I think it's because we have bought into the culture idea that seeing is believing. So even in the church, we don't see him. And when we get overwhelmed with some kind of a circumstance, we're looking for a way out of this. We've got to get out of this because we don't see him in front of our eyes. You see, we've borrowed from the culture. I can't see him, so I really wonder if he's actually trustworthy. How do we answer that? Well, consider this verse from Hebrews 12. Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. You want to talk about ultimate purpose. You want to talk about suffering with purpose. See, Jesus suffered with ultimate purpose. We may question why God permits us to suffer, why he permits evil in the world. Perhaps we don't know exactly why, but we certainly know what it's not. It's not that he doesn't care. Jesus Christ left his splendor and comfort and came and entered our suffering world. He walked as we did. Our confession says that he suffered the indignities of this life, and then he walked a lonely road to the cross. And his suffering was not some morbid end in itself. His suffering and death were for a much greater purpose. He lived perfectly. That means he never wavered in his purpose. He never disappointed his Father. He never gave in to carnal passions. He lived a perfect life for us because we are continually wavering in our purpose and walking away from the Father continually. We are continually suffering with no purpose, full of fear. That has characterized my life for most of it. For most of it. Suffering without purpose. Full of fear. But Jesus had ultimate purpose, lived this perfect life because I didn't. Because you didn't. He lived that perfect life for you, and then he went to the cross to pay for all that stuff. To pay for your fear and your lack of trusting him in hard situations. He died the death we deserve. No one has suffered like Jesus, and he experienced hell on the cross for us. He took our punishment. So we can look at all of the supposed wisdom of our world, and we can envy what they have and their seeming life of ease and self-focus. We can ride downtown in Boston and look at Harvard and envy all the brains that live there and all the MIT and Boston College and see all of the corporate world and how they're doing big things and all that kind of stuff. But if that's where our hope is, we'll have no clue when suffering comes. And that's a life of insecurity and confusion. But if we trust in the Lord, like the passage tells us, it'll be a life of stability, a life of steadfastness. See, there's two ways to go with this. Instability, restlessness. It's another translation of the term that is used there. A life of restlessness. And you know, when you're suffering and you don't see the purpose, you are restless. I used to have to get up and walk and walk and walk back and forth. I couldn't control it. I was restless. Then we get this passage from the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians. Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. On the wall of his bedroom, Charles Spurgeon had a plaque with Isaiah 48:10 on it, which says, I have chosen thee in the furnace of affliction. And then he wrote, it is no mean thing to be chosen of God. God's choice makes chosen men choice men. We are chosen not in the palace, but in the furnace. In the furnace, beauty is marred, fashion is destroyed, strength is melted, glory is consumed. Yet here, eternal love reveals its secrets and declares its choice. That eternal love that reveals secrets is the wisdom of God. The way of the cross is the way of power, of joy, of purpose, and yes, wisdom. Which one will you choose? That's the gospel, and it does change everything. Let's pray.